from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is Tales from the South.
We'll never know how she accomplished this feat. Put it down to fear and adrenaline, or maybe the good Lord watching over her.
Recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
I knew the right thing to do, and I was going to do it no matter what the consequences. I was not going to tell anybody. Ever.
Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story, as if they were sitting on the porch with you.
I don't know why this is true. Perhaps it is because the alcohol is consumed during the 2 or 3 days it takes to get your average high society bride hitched would be sufficient to stun a pack of mules.
So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
Keep yourself quiet. Hey, sweet darling, write me a song. Tell me I'm a teacher, never do me wrong. Way, Dixieland. In Dixieland, where I was born early on a frosty morning. Look away, Dixieland. Do 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 do. Dixieland.
How's everybody doing tonight? How about tonight's music by Bonnie Montgomery? Do y'all like Bonnie? She has CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at BonnieMontgomeryMusic.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? This week, our writers let us in on some very interesting family secrets that have been kept for generations, years, or just one night. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Robin Ridgel spills the beans on a secret she's kept for years, and we'll end the night with Arthur Paul Bowen, as he is the recipient of what should be a guilty conscience. But let's start the night with Ann Nieto, as she tells us a secret that her family has kept for generations and we can never tell, in The Day My Daddy Told a Lie. It was about mid-morning when my neighbor, Mr. Brennan's male and female hogs, we'll call them the hog family, waddled straight through the gate, up the porch steps, and into the chicken feed. My mother, who had never fired a gun before or since, focused on Mr. Hogg. However, from the strain of pregnancy or the fear of Mr. Brennan, or just not knowing which end was up, Mama sprinkled that hog from the wrong direction and let loose a load of buckshot. Straight through his heart, he dropped like a rock on the first day of gravity. It was in Black Rock, Arkansas, back during the Great Depression. I don't know what was so great about it, but there you are. Mama and Daddy had been married a year, and Mama was 9 months pregnant. I mean, their motto was, "Why waste time?" Now, they were living in an old farmhouse out in the country, and Daddy was teaching school, and Mama, who was a natural-born coward, and she didn't relish being left all alone in the old homestead because she was sure she heard ghosts in the next room or upstairs or down the hall. But more than ghosts, she was a little nervous about her nearest neighbors a mile or two down the road. It wasn't all paranoia on Mama's part, because Mr. Brennan, the neighbor, once had gotten upset during a game of chance and shot the cheater dead. He had the reputation of being a mean man, and he did his best to live up to his reputation. Well, Mr. Brennan had this couple of hogs who seemed to be happily married and went everywhere together, including my folks' front porch where sacks of chicken feed were stored. The loving couple, after a meal of slops in their own yard, would come over for chicken feed for dessert, which was proving mighty expensive for a poor school teacher and his pregnant wife. When Mama would try to chase the hogs off the porch with a broom, they would just snort and ignore her and keep right on eating. Not having much respect for a pregnant woman who, in all probability, would only have a litter of one, maybe two, possibly three. Now, if she could have produced 12 or 13 at a time, they might have paid more attention. Well, Mr. Brennan wasn't exactly the type of neighbor one could complain to about his hogs or anything else, for that matter. So my daddy decided he'd take matters into his own hands, or put them in my mama's hands, to be exact. He got out his old shotgun, filled it with buckshot, and instructed Mama to sprinkle the hog's backside with that buckshot, which would surely discourage Mr. and Mrs. Hog from growing fat on purloined chicken feed. However, the backside was switched around to the front side, and Mama stood on her front porch with her smoking gun. Mr. Hog's maid had indeed been scared off by the gunshot, but Mama's immediate problem was what to do with the result of her sharpshooting. Now, here's this woman, expecting to drop her first baby any day, scared to death. Maybe Mr. Brennan heard that fateful shot and would come to investigate, all alone with a 100-pound dead hog on her front porch. Well, this is the part of the story that defies belief, but it's true, as true as true can be. My fat, pregnant, scared to death mama dragged that 100-pound dead hog off the porch, through the yard, out back to a storage stack, and locked the door. We'll never know how she accomplished this feat. Put it down to fear and adrenaline, or maybe the good Lord watching over her. Mama stayed inside all afternoon, expecting to hear that dreaded knock at the door any minute, and sure enough, about 3 o'clock, came. Fearfully opening the door, Mama confronted not Mr. Brennan, but his wife, who had for her traveling companion of all things, Mrs. Hogg. Mrs. Brennan asked Mama if she had seen her hog, as his maid had come home that morning without him. "No," said Mama, praying God would forgive her. "I haven't seen him for a while, but I'll let you know if he turns up." Meanwhile, Mrs. Hogg was sniffing the ground in the front yard and seemed to pick up a trail heading straight for the storage shack and the corpus delicti of her dead mate. "Now, what's that crazy pig doing now?" inquired Mrs. Brennan. "Oh," said Mama, deciding in for a penny and for a pound, "she probably smells chicken feed stored in the shed. Your hogs like chicken feed, you know." Mrs. Brennan agreed they did and finally persuaded her female hog to come along home. That night, when Daddy got home from school, he found a very distraught wife who told him the whole story and added, as an aside, that she should have listened to her mom and never got married in the first place. Just about then, Mama's two brothers showed up for a visit. Well, it took both my uncles and my daddy to load that dead hog into the Model A. and take it to the crossroads and dump it in the ditch. The next morning, on the way to school, my daddy's Model A serving as a school bus for all the neighborhood children, including three or four of the Brennan kids, came to that very same crossroads. Daddy says, slowing down, "Well, I declare, boys, that looks like your old missing pig down there in that ditch." The Brennan children, plus everybody else, crowded out for a closer look, and sure enough, there, big as life, was their dead pig. "Boys, it looks to me like your old hog got hit by a car and was thrown into the ditch," says Daddy, telling part of the truth at least. Well, all the children agreed that it did look that way and went home that afternoon and dutifully shared the story with their folks. I guess they accepted it. I don't know if the hog's maid accepted it, but she stayed away from the chicken feed from then on. Must have brought too many painful memories back. So that's the end of the story. Oh, by the way, I'd appreciate it if you would keep this story to yourselves. We're not sure about what Mr. Brennan might come gunning for us if he ever found out the truth.
Ann Nieto is currently the director of the Literacy Council of White County. She was born in Black Rock, Arkansas, is currently living in Searcy. A former school teacher, she is now very active in community theater as an actress and director. She is the mother of three daughters, six grandchildren, and two great-grandchildren. In our next story, Robin Ridgel confesses to a secret she's kept since childhood in It Could Happen to Anyone.
One morning, when I was about 15 years old, my mother woke me up early and said, "We are going to can the peas that we had shelled the night before." I'd been helping Mama can since I was 12, so this was nothing new. It was early, too early for a teenager to be up in the light of day, but I rolled out of bed and eventually stumbled down the hallway and into the warm kitchen. Mama had her back to me as she stood over the sink. "Robin," she said as I plopped down at the kitchen table and lay my head on the cool yellow Formica tabletop, "I don't feel good. I need to rest, so you're going to get to can the peas all by yourself." Suddenly, I was wide awake. I jerked my head up and I squinted in the light. Was she crazy? I couldn't do that by myself. But try as I most certainly did, I could not talk her out of it. She was going to be in the living room, and if I had any questions, she would be right there. She walked out of the kitchen and she was gone. I took a deep breath. Although I knew that Mama was making a big mistake, there was really nothing I could do. I stood up from the table, walked over to the sink, and laid a paper towel beside the sink to put the trash on. When I started washing the peas, the whole time grumbling about how I had to do everything around here and why couldn't somebody help me sometimes, I washed the peas just like I'd been taught. I was grumbling and washing and grumbling. When I suddenly stopped, my hands full of wet peas, something was looking back at me from the sink. I reached down and I pulled a fat green worm with big black eyes out of the peas. This was not the first ugly worm I'd ever seen, so I didn't give him much thought. He squirmed slowly as I placed him on the paper towel beside the sink, and then I went back to grumbling and washing. On my second wash, I glanced over at the paper towel to check on old Black Eye, and that's when I did a double take, my breath catching in my throat. There was no ugly black-eyed worm on the paper towel. There was no trace of him. I looked everywhere for him, on the floor, under the towel, no worm. I frantically stirred the peas in the water, trying to make the worm come to the top. No worm. My mind was racing. What was I going to do? Then I began to justify the situation. First, the worm was probably not in the peas anyway, and if it was, by the time the peas were cooked and canned, he would just be mush. Also, with Mama being sick and all, I didn't feel it was right to bother her with this minor detail of my day. Right? So I washed the peas the third time, just like I'd been taught, and I put them on to blanch. Mama came in and asked if I needed help. with the possibility of old Black Eye popping to the top of the pan, I told Mama I was doing just fine by myself and I didn't need any help. The rest of the canning process went fine, and as far as I was concerned, there was nothing to worry about. Some months later, I came in for supper, and we were having peas, cornbread, and fried potatoes. And boy, was I hungry. Then Mama started bragging on how this was a jar of peas that I had canned all by myself. Well, I was grinning from ear to ear. My daddy was piling the peas on his plate and saying how he bet they would taste better just because I had canned them. My big brother was suggesting that they might be poisoned. And my little brother was not sure what was going on, but he was happy anyway. I fixed my plate, I put on a good spoonful of peas, and thought that the world was good. Just as I was about to dig into my pile of peas, I looked down, and my fork froze in midair. There, looking back at me at the edge of the peas, was old Black Eye. He was just as fat and just as ugly as he was the first time I saw him. He wasn't mush at all, and as a matter of fact, he looked just fine and he was staring right at me. I quickly covered him with peas as my eyes darted around the table. Everyone in my family was either about to take a bite of or was already chewing my peas. My hands started sweating. I didn't know what to do. Should I say something? My whole family was eating peas that had been cooked with a worm. If I told, I knew I would be in trouble, and I also knew my big brother would never let me live it down. If I didn't tell, I would have to carry this knowledge around with me for the rest of my life. Suddenly, I knew what to do. I knew the right thing to do, and I was going to do it no matter what the consequences. I was not going to tell anybody, ever. After all, what good could telling the truth do anybody? Everybody would get sick, nobody would ever be able to eat peas again, and they might even have to have therapy. I could not do that to my family. I love them too much to tell them the truth. I announced that my stomach was hurting. I stood up from the table. I emptied my plate into the dog bucket, worm and all. I slipped down the hallway to my room, followed by my big brother's taunting words that I wouldn't even eat my own peas. But in my heart, I knew I was doing him a favor, even though he did have two helpings. I would like to end this story by saying that I eventually came clean and told my family what happened. That would just be a lie. Both my parents have passed away. My big brother lives in California, and little brother was too young to remember anyway. Why should I dredge up the past just to ease my conscience? After all, it could happen to anyone.
Robin Ridgel has lived in Prescott, Arkansas for 41 years. She has recently published a book of short stories and poems called Ain't Life Funny. Robin loves to tell stories and make people laugh. In our final story of the night, Arthur Paul Bowen is let in on a very interesting secret on a very important day in This Night They Say Was Made for Love.
Can we talk about something? The groom asked an hour or so before the service in the sanctuary of the old Emmanuel Baptist Church in downtown Little Rock. I'd been hired to sing at his wedding. The father of the groom was a local politician. The bride was some doctor's daughter. Serious bucks had been expended in the service of this endeavor. He was rubbing his forehead and his eyes were darting around the room. This is always a good sign that serious hilarity is about to ensue. Let me just say at this point that virtually no other aspect of human endeavor may consistently be relied upon to summon forth trouble of the worst sort than a fancy wedding in the South. I don't know why this is true. Perhaps it is because the alcohol that is consumed during the 2 or 3 days it takes to get your average high society bride hitched would be sufficient to stun a pack of mules. Maybe it's because excessive use of both tobacco products and Valium sends exceedingly mixed signals to the central nervous system. Or maybe the latent Southern malevolence that brought the nation the big surprise known as Fort Sumter just naturally comes out during nuptials. Perhaps you have your own opinions. But I have sung at enough high society weddings to come to expect serious and abiding weirdness to appear unbidden before the bride tosses the garter. This is one of the reasons I have always preferred doing funerals. Wait for it. There is typically far less drama that, and at a funeral, you're guaranteed that at least one person in attendance will not complain about the music. I followed the groom into a hallway behind the baptistry. We had to move because the late Dr. W.O. Vaught was in the pulpit doing an extended pre-service mic check so as to ensure that his voice was properly Jehovian. And I was having trouble hearing anything else. Okay, how long do you think it will take you to sing the Lord's Prayer, he whispered. Albert Hay Malott's Lord's Prayer is generally inflicted upon the congregation after the vows while the wedding party stands before the altar. This service was no different. I don't know, I said. You heard us do it last night at the rehearsal. Why? Well, could you know? I don't know. Speed it up. I'm not sure I'm following you. The forehead rubbing became much more intense. Okay, he said. After the rehearsal dinner, we all went back to the hotel, okay?
Okay.
And we were drinking pretty good. Okay, I said. And I got to tell you, we got pretty drunk. Keep going. Well, Carol, the radiant bride, she was pretty tired and went back to her room. What on earth does this have to do with the music? Is she not feeling well? The groom locked his hands behind his head. He looked up at the ceiling. He exhaled. Okay, he said, as he continued his upward gaze. We need to speed up the Lord's Prayer because I slept with the maid of honor last night. Who is all kind of pissed at me right now. Oh, I'll just bet. Anyway, women can just sense some things, you know? Like you waking up with her best friend on her wedding day. Those kinds of things. Well, you don't have to put it like that. Sorry, didn't mean to make it sound worse than it is. Anyway, the less time those two spend standing next to each other, the better. Man, you got to help me out. If this wedding doesn't go through, my dad will kill me. If her daddy finds out what you did, he may help out. I said, trying to be helpful. He turned pale, or paler. Look, I'll see what I can do, I said, as I headed back to the sanctuary. But listen, when y'all get up there at the altar, whatever you do, do not cast a loving gaze, or any other kind of gaze, for that matter, on anybody except Carol or the preacher. You got that? And with that, I left him to sweat through his tuxedo. Dr. Vaught had mercifully finished his mic check by the time I returned, which meant that it was finally quiet enough for Richard, the organist, to set the ranks prior to the service in peace. I slid next to him on the bench. I pressed my shoulder into his. Well, hello, he said as he pulled pistons and hit buttons. Richard, I said, we have a problem. Well, of course we do. It wouldn't be a wedding without one, let me guess. The bride's mother has a helpful suggestion about the music. That's always fun. Somebody in the groom's party got arrested.
You have laryngitis.
The usual? No. The problem is that the groom is an idiot. Listen, he just told me that he carried on with the maid of honor last night.
The maid of honor? What?
He needs us to pick up the pace on the Lord's Prayer so that his new bride doesn't catch a weird vibe between her soulmate and her soon-to-be former girlfriend. While they're all up there on the altar with nothing to do but listen to me sing.
The maid of honor.
Listen, Richard, we don't have time for this. We got to blow through the Lord's Prayer before eyes get clawed and hair gets pulled right up there in front of God and W.O. Vaught. Not a problem, Richard replied. I'll keep an eye on you in the mirror over here. You just direct with your head, and I'll follow whither thou goest and all that, right?
A maid of honor!
And so it was that the first presto version of the Lord's Prayer was performed on that blessed day at Emmanuel Baptist Church. The groom kissed his bride. The wedding party departed. No gunfire was exchanged in the narthex. I turned pages for Richard as he played the traveling music while the unsuspecting congregation departed. Can you believe that? I whispered. Oh, of course I can, Richard whispered back. It's a wedding. I just don't really pay attention to people fooling around beforehand unless somebody, well, makes a pass at me. What, like somebody in the bride's party? No, Richard said. The expression on his face made it clear that he regarded me as the stupidest person on the planet at that particular moment. Oh, I said. I turned another page. Isn't that kind of thing pretty un-Baptist? I asked. Richard shrugged. It may be un-Baptist, but it sure does happen. Crazy stuff happens at weddings. The bigger the wedding, the crazier the stuff. You should know that by now, Paul. This may come as a surprise, but it is my understanding that the marriage solemnized by Dr. Vite and me knew trouble in its early stages. Really? Indeed, the bride and groom eventually got divorced. I know, I'm stunned. And our gallant hero got remarried to, guess who? His original bridesmaid of, well, the maid in charge of standing next to his first wife's immediate left. So some good did come of this after all. I just hope his second trip to the altar was relatively uneventful. I can only hope that he learned a lesson from his first walk down the aisle and that he stayed somewhere with limited access to women and alcohol the night before he re-entered into the honorable estate. I do not give advice about either golf or relationships, but let this be a cautionary tale for all the grooms to be out there. This is simple. If you just have to blow up the wagon the night before your wedding, don't do it with a member of your fiancé's bridal party. She will figure it out. Because women can sense that stuff, you know?
Arthur Paul Bowen is a recovering lawyer and writer who lives in the People's Republic of Hillcrest in Little Rock. He is a frequent contributor to Tales from the South and has written for the Dallas Morning News, the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, AY Magazine, the Arkansas Times, Soiree Magazine, and bourbonandboots.com. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.